on the nervous doodlings I had traced around these words before heading out to his room, I was trying to recover the memory of last night's jitters. Perhaps I wanted to relive the night's anxieties, both to mask tonight's and to remind myself that if my worst fears had suddenly been dispelled once I'd entered his room, perhaps they might end no differently tonight and be as easily subdued once I'd heard his footsteps. But I couldn't even remember last night's anxieties. They were completely overshadowed by what followed them and seemed to belong to a segment of time to which I had no access whatsoever. Everything about last night had suddenly vanished. I remembered nothing. I tried to whisper, "get lost," to myself as a way of jump-starting my memory. The words had seemed so real last night. Now they were just two words struggling to make sense. And then I realized it. What I was experiencing tonight was unlike anything I'd experienced in my life. This was much worse. I didn't even know what to call this. On second thought, I didn't even know what to call last night's jitters either. I had taken a giant step last night, yet here I was, no wiser and no more sure of things than I'd been before feeling him all over me. We might as well not even have slept together. At least last night there was the fear of failing, the fear of being thrown out or called the very name I had used on others. Now that I had overcome that fear, had this anxiety been present all along, though latent, like a presage and warning of killer reefs beyond the squall? And why did I care where he was? Wasn't this what I wanted for both of us? Butchers and bakers and all that? Why feel so unhinged just because he wasn't there, or because he'd given me the slip? Why sense that all I was doing now was waiting for him? Waiting, waiting, waiting. What was it about waiting that was beginning to feel like torture? If you are with someone, Oliver, it is time to come home. No questions asked, I promise. Just don't keep me waiting. If he doesn't show up in 10 minutes, I'll do something. 10 minutes later, feeling helpless and hating myself for feeling helpless, I resolve to wait another, this time for real, 10 minutes. 20 minutes later, I couldn't stand it any longer. I put on a sweater, walked off the balcony and came downstairs. I'd go to B, if I had to, and check for myself. I was on my way to the bike shed, already debating whether to head out to N first, where people tended to stay up and party much later than in B, and was cursing myself for not putting air in the tires earlier this morning, when suddenly something told me I should stop dead in my tracks and try not to disturb Ankise, who slept in the hut nearby. Sinister Ankise. Everyone said he was sinister. Had I suspected it all along? I must have. The fall from the bike, and Kisei's peasant ointment, the kindness with which he took care of him and cleaned up the scrape. But down below, along the rocky shore, in the moonlight, I caught sight of him. He was sitting on one of the higher rocks, wearing his sailor's white and blue striped sweater, with the buttons always undone along his shoulder, which he'd purchased in Sicily early that summer. He was doing nothing, just hugging his knees, listening to the ripples lap against the rocks below him. Looking at him now from the balustrade, I felt something so tender for him that it reminded me of how eagerly I'd rushed to B to catch him before he'd even made it to the post office. This was the best person I'd ever known in my life. I had chosen him well. I opened the gate and skipped down the several rocks and reached him. "I was waiting for you," I said. "I thought you'd gone to sleep. I even thought you didn't want to." "No, waiting. I just turned the lights off." I looked up at our house. The window shutters were all closed. I bent down and kissed him on his neck. It was the first time I had kissed him with feeling, not just desire. He put his arm around me, harmless if anyone saw. "What were you doing?" I asked. "Thinking. About. Things. Going back to the States. Courses I have to teach this fall. The book. You. Me?" "Me?" He was mimicking my modesty. No one else? No one else. He was silent for a while. I come here every night and just sit here. Sometimes I spend hours. All by yourself? He nodded. I never knew. I thought, I know what you thought. The news couldn't have made me happier. It had obviously been shadowing everything between us. I decided not to press the matter. This spot is probably what I'll miss most, then upon reflection. I've been so happy in B. It sounded like a preamble to farewells. I was looking out towards there, he continued, pointing to the horizon, and thinking that in 2 weeks I'll be back at Columbia. He was right. I had made a point never to count the days, at first because I didn't want to think how long he'd stay here with us, later because I didn't want to face how few were his remaining days. All this means that in 10 days, when I look out to this spot, you won't be here. I don't know what I'll do then. At least you'll be elsewhere, where there are no memories. He squeezed my shoulder, Tam. The way you think sometimes. You'll be fine. I might. Then I might not. We wasted so many days. So many weeks. Wasted? I don't know. Perhaps we just needed time to figure out if this is what we wanted. Some of us made things purposely difficult. Me? I nodded. You know what we were doing exactly one night ago? He smiled. I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not sure either. But I'm glad we did. Will you be okay? I'll be okay. I slipped a hand into his pants. I do love being here with you. It was my way of saying, I've been happy here as well. I tried to picture what happy here meant to him. Happy once he got here after imagining what the place might look like. Happy doing his work on those scorching mornings in heaven. Happy biking back and forth from the translator. Happy disappearing into town every night and coming back so late. Happy with my parents and dinner drudgery. Happy with his poker friends and all the other friends he had made in town, about whom I knew nothing whatsoever. One day he might tell me. I wondered what part I played in the overall happiness package. Meanwhile, tomorrow, if we went for an early morning swim, I might be overcome again with this surfeit of self-loathing. I wondered if one got used to that, or does one accrue a deficit of malaise so large that one learns to find ways to consolidate it in one lump feeling with its own amnesties and grace periods? Or does this presence of the other, who yesterday morning felt almost like an intruder, become ever more necessary because it shields us from our own hell, so that the very person who causes our torment by daybreak is the same who will relieve it at night? The next morning, we went for a swim together. It was scarcely past 6 o'clock, and the fact it was so early gave an energized quality to our exercise. Later, as he performed his own version of the dead man's float, I wanted to hold him, as swimming instructors do when they hold your body so lightly they seem to keep you afloat with barely a touch of their fingers. Why did I feel older than he was at this moment? I wanted to protect him from everything this morning, from the rocks, from the jellyfish, now that jellyfish season was upon us, from Enkize, whose sinister leer, as he'd trundle into the garden to turn on the sprinklers, constantly pulling out weeds wherever he'd turned, even when it rained, even when he spoke to you, even when he threatened to leave us, seemed to tease out every secret you thought you'd neatly buried from his gaze. How are you? I asked, mimicking his question to me yesterday morning. You should know. At breakfast, I couldn't believe what seized me, but I found myself cutting the top of his soft-boiled egg before Mafalda intervened, or before he had smashed it with his spoon. I had never done this for anyone else in my life, and yet here I was making certain not a speck of the shell fell into his egg. He was happy with his egg. When Mafalda brought him his daily polpo, I was happy for him. Domestic bliss. Just because he'd let me be his top last night. I caught my father staring at me as I finished slicing off the top of his second soft-boiled egg. Americans never know how to do it, I said. I'm sure they have their way, he said. The foot that came to rest on mine under the table told me that perhaps I should let it go and assume my father was onto something. He's no fool, he said to me later that morning as he was getting ready to head up to B. Want me to come with? No, better keep a low profile. You should work on your hiding today. Later. Later. Marzia called that morning while he was about to leave. He almost winked when he handed me the telephone. There was no hint of irony. Nothing that didn't remind me, unless I was mistaken, and I don't think I was, that what we had between us was the total transparency that exists among friends only. Perhaps we were friends first and lovers second. But perhaps this is what lovers are. When I think back to our last 10 days together, I see an early morning swim, our lazy breakfasts, the ride up to town, work in the garden, lunches, our afternoon naps, more work in the afternoon, tennis maybe, after dinners in the piazzetta, and every night, the kind of lovemaking that can run circles around time. Looking back to those days, I don't think there was ever a minute other than the half an hour or so he spent with his translator, or when I'd managed to steal a few hours with Marzia, when we weren't together. When did you know about me? I asked him one day. I was hoping he'd say, when I squeezed your shoulder and you almost wilted in my arms, or when you got wet under your bathing suit that one afternoon when we chatted in your room. Something along those lines. When you blushed, he said. Me? We'd been talking about translating poetry. It was early in the morning, during his very first week with us. He'd started working earlier than usual that day, probably because we already enjoyed our spontaneous conversations while the breakfast table was being laid out under the linden tree, and we were eager to spend some time together. He'd asked me if I'd ever translated poetry. I said I had. Why, had he? Yes. He was reading Leopardi and had landed on a few verses that were impossible to translate. We had begun speaking back and forth, neither of us realizing how far a conversation started on the fly could go, because all the while delving deeper into Leopardi's world, where we were also finding occasional side alleys where our natural sense of humor and our love for clowning were given free play. We translated the passage into English, then from English to ancient Greek, then back to gobbledygooglish, to gobbledygitalian. Leopardi's closing lines of "to the moon" were so warped that it brought bursts of laughter as we kept repeating the nonsense lines in Italian, when suddenly there was a moment of silence. And when I looked up at him, he was staring at me point blank, that icy, glassy look of his which always disconcerted me. I was struggling to say something, and when he asked how I knew so many things, I had the presence of mind to say something about being a professor's son. I was not always eager to show off my knowledge, especially with someone who could so easily intimidate me. I had nothing to fight back with, nothing to add, nothing to throw into the muddy waters between us, nowhere to hide or run for cover. I felt as exposed as a stranded lamb on the dry, waterless plains of the Serengeti. The staring was no longer a part of the conversation, or even of the fooling around with translation. It had superseded it and become its own subject, except that neither dared nor wanted to bring it up. And yes, there was such a luster in his eyes that I had to look away. And when I had looked back at him, his gaze hadn't moved, and he was still focused on my face, as if to say, "You looked away, and you've come back. Will you be looking away again soon?" Which was why I had to look away once more, as if immersed in thought, yet all the while scrambling for something to say, the way a fish struggles for water in a muddied pond that's fast drying up in the heat. He must have known exactly what I was feeling. What made me blush in the end was not the natural embarrassment of the moment when I could tell he'd caught me trying to hold his gaze, only to let mine scamper to safety. What made me blush was the thrilling possibility, unbelievable as I wanted it to remain, that he might actually like me, and that he liked me in just the way I liked him. For weeks I had mistaken his stare for barefaced hostility. I was wide of the mark. It was simply a shy man's way of holding someone else's gaze. We were, it finally dawned on me, the two shyest persons in the world. My father was the only one who had seen through him from the very start. "Do you like Leopardi?" I asked, break the silence, but also to suggest that it was the topic of Leopardi that had caused me to seem somewhat distracted during a pause in our conversation. "Yes, very much. I like him very much, too." I'd always known I wasn't speaking about Leopardi. The question was, did he? I knew I was making you uncomfortable, but I just had to make sure. "So you knew all this time?" "Let's just say I was pretty sure." In other words, it had started just days after his arrival. Had everything since been pretense then? And all these swings between friendship and indifference, what were they? His and my way of keeping stealthy tabs on each other while disclaiming that we were? Or were they simply as cunning a way as any to stave off each other, hoping that what we felt was indeed genuine indifference? "Why didn't you give me a sign?" I said. "I did. At least I tried." "When?" "After tennis once. I touched you, as a way of showing I liked you, but the way you reacted made me feel as I'd almost molested you. I decided to keep my distance." Our best moments were in the afternoon. After lunch, I'd go upstairs for a nap just when coffee was about to be served. Then, when the lunch guests had left or slunk away to rest in the guest house, my father would either retire to his study or steal a nap with my mother. By 2 in the afternoon, an intense silence would settle over the house, over the world, it seemed, interrupted here and there, either by the cooing of doves or by Anchise's hammer when he was working on his tools and was trying not to make too much noise. I liked hearing him work in the afternoon, and even when his occasional banging or sawing woke me up, or when the knife grinder would start his whetstone running every Wednesday afternoon, it left me feeling as restful and at peace with the world as I would feel years later on hearing a distant foghorn off Cape Cod in the middle of the night. Oliver liked to keep the windows and shutters wide open in the afternoon, with just the swelling sheer curtains between us and life beyond, because it was a crime to block away so much sunlight and keep such a landscape from view, especially when you didn't have it all lifelong, he said. Then the rolling fields of the valley leading up to the hills seemed to sit in a rising mist of olive green. Sunflowers, grapevines, swatches of lavender, and those squat and humble olive trees stooping like gnarled, aged scarecrows, gawking through our window as we lay naked on my bed. The smell of his sweat, which was the smell of my sweat. And next to me, my man-woman, whose man-woman I was. And all around us, Mafalda's chamomile-scented laundry detergent, which was the scent of the torrid afternoon world of our house. I look back on those days and regret none of it. Not the risks, not the shame, not the total lack of foresight. The lyric cast of the sun, the teeming fields with tall plants nodding away under the intense mid-afternoon heat, the squeak of our wooden floors, or the scrape of the clay ashtray pushed ever so slightly on the marble slab that used to sit on my nightstand. I knew that our minutes were numbered, but I didn't dare count them, just as I knew where all of this was headed, but didn't care to read the signposts. This was a time when I intentionally failed to drop breadcrumbs for my return journey. Instead, I ate them. He could turn out to be a total creep. He could change me or ruin me forever, while time and gossip might ultimately disembowel everything we shared and trim the whole thing down till nothing but fish bones remained. I might miss this day, or I might do far better, but I'd always know that on those afternoons in my bedroom, I'd held my moment. One morning, though, I awoke and saw the whole of B, overborne by dark, lowering clouds racing across the sky. I knew exactly what this spelled. Autumn was just around the corner. A few hours later, the clouds totally cleared, and the weather, as though to make up for its little prank, seemed to erase every hint of fall from our lives and gave us one of the most temperate days of the season. But I had heeded the warning, and as is said of juries who have heard inadmissible evidence before it is stricken from the record, I suddenly realized that we were on borrowed time, that this time is always borrowed, and that the lending agency exacts its premium precisely when we are least prepared to pay and need to borrow more. Suddenly, I began to take mental snapshots of him, picked up the breadcrumbs that fell off our table and collected them for my hideaway, and, to my shame, drew lists. The rock, the berm, the bed, the sound of the ashtray. The rock, the berm, the bed. I wished I were like those soldiers in films who run out of bullets and toss away their guns as though they would never again have any use for them, or like runaways in the desert who, rather than ration the water in the ground, yield to thirst and swill away, then drop their gourd in their tracks. Instead, I squirreled away the small things so that in the lean days ahead, glimmers from the past might bring back the warmth. I began reluctantly to steal from the present to pay off debts I knew I'd incur in the future. This, I knew, was as much a crime as closing the shutters on sunny afternoons. But I also knew that in Mafalda's superstitious world, anticipating the worst was a sure way of preventing it from happening. When we went on a walk one night, and he told me that he'd soon be heading back home, I realized how futile my alleged foresight had been. Bombs never fall on the same spot. This one, for all my premonitions, fell exactly in my hideaway. Oliver was leaving for the States the second week of August. A few days into the month, he said he wanted to spend 3 days in Rome and use that time to work on the final draft of his manuscript with his Italian publisher. Then he'd fly directly home. Would I like to join him? I said yes. Shouldn't I ask my parents first? No need. They never said no. Yes, but wouldn't they? They wouldn't. On hearing that Oliver was leaving earlier than anticipated and would spend a few days in Rome, my mother asked, with Il Cowboy's permission, of course, if I might accompany him. My father was not against it. My mother helped me pack. Would I need a jacket in case the publisher wished to take us out to dinner? There'd be no dinner. Besides, why would I be asked to join? I should still take a jacket, she thought. I wanted to take a backpack, travel as everyone my age did. Do as you please. Still, she helped me empty and repack the backpack when it was clear there wasn't room for everything I wanted to take along. You're only going for 2 to 3 days. Neither Oliver nor I had been precise about our last days together. Mother would never know how her 2 to 3 days cut me that morning. Did we know which hotel we were planning to stay in? Pensione something or other. Never heard of it, but then who was she to know, she said. My father would have none of it. He made the reservations himself. It's a gift, he said. Oliver not only packed his own duffel bag, but on the day we were to catch the Direttissimo to Rome, he managed to take out his suitcase and place it on the exact same spot in his bedroom where I had plopped it down the day of his arrival. On that day, I had fast-forwarded to the moment when I'd have my room back. Now I wondered what I'd be willing to give up if only to rewind things back to the afternoon in late June when I took him on the de rigueur tour of our property, and how, with one thing leading to the next, we'd found ourselves approaching the empty scorched lot by the abandoned train tracks where I received my first dose of so many laters. Anyone my age would much rather have taken a nap than trekked to the back reaches of our property that day. Clearly, I already knew what I was doing. The symmetry of it all, or was it the emptied, seeming ransacked neatness of his room, tied a knot in my throat. It reminded me less of a hotel room when you wait for the porter to help you take your things downstairs after a glorious stay that was ending too soon, than of a hospital room after your belongings have all been packed away, while the next patient, who hasn't been admitted yet, still waits in the emergency room exactly as you waited there yourself a week earlier. This was a test run for our final separation, like looking at someone on a respirator before it's finally turned off days later. I was happy that the room would revert to me. In his room, it would be easier to remember our nights. No, better to keep my current room. Then at least I could pretend he was still in his. And if he wasn't there, that he was still out, as he so frequently used to be on those nights when I'd counted the minutes, the hours, the sounds. When I opened his closet, I noticed that he had left a bathing suit, a pair of underwear, his chinos, and a clean shirt on a few hangers. I recognized the shirt, billowy, and I recognized the suit, red. This was for when he'd gone swimming one last time this morning. "I must tell you about this bathing suit," I said when I closed his closet door. "Tell me what?" "I'll tell you on the train." But I told him all the same, "Just promise to let me keep it after you're gone."
"That's all?"
"Well, wear it a lot today. And don't swim in it."
Sick and twisted.
Sick and twisted, and very, very sad. "I've never seen you like this." "I want billowy too. And the espadrilles. And the sunglasses. And you." On the train, I told him about the day we thought he'd drowned, and how I was determined to ask my father to round up as many fishermen as he could to go look for him, and when they found him, to light a pyre on our shore, while I grabbed Mafalda's knife from the kitchen and ripped out his heart, because that heart and his shirt were all I'd ever have to show for my life. A heart and a shirt. His heart wrapped in a damp shirt. Like Anchise's fish. Part 3. The San Clemente Syndrome. We arrived at Stazione Termini around 7 p.m. on a Wednesday evening. The air was thick and muggy, as if Rome had been awash in a rainstorm that had come and gone and relieved none of the dampness. With dusk scarcely an hour away, the street lights glistened through dense halos, while the lighted storefronts seemed doused in gleaming colors of their own invention. Dampness clung to every forehead and every face. I wanted to caress his face. I couldn't wait to get to our hotel and shower and throw myself on the bed, knowing all the while that unless we had good air conditioning, I'd be no better off after the shower. But I also loved the languor that sat upon the city, like a lover's tired and unsteady arm resting on your shoulders. Maybe we'd have a balcony. I could use a balcony. Sit on its cool marble steps and watch the sun set over Rome. Mineral water. Or beer. And tiny snacks to munch on. My father had booked us one of the most luxurious hotels in Rome. Oliver wanted to take the first taxi. I wanted to take a bus instead. I longed for crowded buses. I wanted to go into a bus, wedge my way into the sweating mass of people, with him pushing his way behind me. But seconds after hopping on the bus, we decided to get out. This was too real, we joked. I backed out through the incoming press of infuriated homegoers who couldn't understand what we were doing. I managed to step on a woman's foot.
"E non chiede manco scusa, doesn't even say he's sorry,"
she hissed to those around her who had just jostled their way into the bus and were not letting us squeeze out. Finally, we hailed a cab. Noting the name of our hotel and hearing us speak English, the cabbie proceeded to make several unexplained turns.
"Inutile prendere tante scocciatore."
"No need for so many shortcuts. We're in no rush," I said in Roman dialect. To our delight, the larger of our adjoining bedrooms had both a balcony and a window, and when we opened the French windows, the glistening domes of numberless churches reflected the sun set in the vast, unencumbered vista below us. Someone had sent us a bunch of flowers and a bowl filled with fruit. The note came from Oliver's Italian publisher. Come to the bookstore around 8:30. Bring your manuscript. There's a party for one of our authors. Ti aspettiamo. We're waiting you. We had not planned on doing anything except going for dinner and wander the streets afterward. Am I invited, though? I asked, feeling a tad uncomfortable. You are now, he replied. We picked at the bowl of fruit sitting by the television cabinet and peeled figs for each other. He said he was going to take a shower. When I saw him naked, I immediately got undressed as well. Just for a second, I said, as our bodies touched, for I loved the dampness that clung all over his. I wish you didn't have to wash. His smell reminded me of Marzia's, and how she too always seemed to exude that brine of the seashore on those days when there isn't a breeze on the beaches and all you smell is the raw, ashen scent of scalding sand. I loved the salt of his arms, of his shoulders, along the ridges of his spine. They were still new to me. If we lie down now, there'll be no book party, he said. These words, spoken from a height of bliss it seemed no one could steal from us, would take me back to this hotel room and to this damp Ferragosto evening as both of us leaned stark naked with our arms on the windowsill, overlooking an unbearably hot Roman late, late afternoon, both of us still smelling of the stuffy compartment on the southbound train that was probably nearing Naples by now, and on which we'd slept, my head resting on his in full view of the other passengers. Leaning out into the evening air, I knew that this might never be given to us again, and yet I couldn't bring myself to believe it. He too must have had the same thought as we surveyed the magnificent cityscape, smoking and eating fresh figs, shoulder to shoulder, each wanting to do something to mark the moment, which was why, yielding to an impulse that couldn't have felt more natural at the time, I let my left hand rub his buttocks, and then began to stick my middle finger into him as he replied, "You keep doing this, and there's definitely no party." I told him to do me a favor and keep staring out the window, but to lean forward a bit, until I had a brainstorm once my entire finger was inside him. We might start, but under no condition would we finish. Then we'd shower and go out and feel like two exposed live wires giving off sparks each time they so much as flicked each other. Look at old houses and want to hug each one. Spot a lamppost on a street corner and like a dog want to spray it. Pass an art gallery and look for the hole in the nude. Cross a face that did no more than smile our way and already initiate moves to undress the whole person and ask her, or him, or both, if they were more than one, to join us for drinks, for dinner, for anything. Find Cupid anywhere in Rome because we'd clipped one of his wings and he was forced to fly in circles. We had never taken a shower together. We had never even been in the same bathroom together. "Don't flush," I said. "I want to look." What I saw brought out strains of compassion for him, for his body, for his life, which suddenly seemed so frail and vulnerable. "Our bodies won't have secrets now," I said as I took my turn and sat down. He'd hopped into the bathtub and was just about to turn on the shower. "I want you to see mine," I said. He did more. He stepped out, kissed me on the mouth, and pressing and massaging my tummy with the flat of his palm, watched the whole thing happen. I wanted no secrets, no screens, nothing between us. Little did I know that if I relished the gust of candor that bound us tighter each time we swore, "My body is your body," it was also because I enjoyed rekindling the tiny lantern of unsuspected shame. Cast a spare glow precisely where part of me would have preferred the dark. Shame trailed instant intimacy. Could intimacy endure once indecency was spent and our bodies had run out of tricks? I don't know that I asked the question, just as I am not sure I am able to answer it today. Was our intimacy paid for in the wrong currency? Or is intimacy the desired product no matter where you find it, how you acquire it, what you pay for it. Black market, gray market, taxed, untaxed, under the table, over the counter. All I knew was that I had nothing left to hide from him. I had never felt freer or safer in my life. We were alone together for 3 days. We knew no one in the city. I could be anyone, say anything, do anything. I felt like a war prisoner who's suddenly been released by an invading army and told that he can start heading home now. No forms to fill out, no debriefing, no questions asked, no buses, no gate passes, no clean clothes to stand in line for. Just start walking. We showered. We wore each other's clothes. We wore each other's underwear. It was my idea. Perhaps all this gave him a second wind of silliness, of youth. Perhaps he'd already been there years earlier and was stopping for a short stay on his return journey home. Perhaps he was playing along, watching me. Perhaps he'd never done it with anyone and I'd showed up in the nick of time. He took his manuscript, his sunglasses, and we'd shut the door to our hotel room, like two live wires. We stepped outside the elevator door, broad smiles for everyone, to the hotel personnel, to the flower vendor in the street, to the girl in the newspaper kiosk. Smile and the world smiles back. "Oliver, I'm happy," I said. He looked at me in wonderment. "You're just horny." "No, happy." Along the way, we caught sight of a human statue of Dante, cloaked in red with an exaggerated aquiline nose and the most scornful frown limned on all his features. The red toga and the red bell cap and the thick-rimmed wooden spectacles gave his already stern face the wizened look of an implacable father confessor. A crowd had gathered around the great bard, who stood motionless on the pavement, his arm crossed defiantly, the whole body standing erect, like a man waiting for Virgil or for an overdue bus. As soon as a tourist threw a coin into a hollowed-out antique book, he simulated the besotted air of a Dante who's just spied his Beatrice, ambling across the Ponte Vecchio and craning his cobra-like neck, would right away moan out like a street performer spitting fire.
"Guido, vorrei che tu e Lapo ed io fossimo presi per incantamento e messi ad un vascel, caro mio vento, per mare andasse a voler vostro e mio."
"Guido, I would that Lapo, thou, and I, led by some strong enchantment, might ascend, a magic ship whose charmed sails should fly with winds at will, where'er our thoughts might wend." How very true, I thought. "Oliver, I wish that you and I, and all those we've held dear, might live forever in one house." Having muttered his sotto voce verses, he would slowly resume his glaring, misanthropic stance until another tourist tossed him a coin.
"Io quando lo sobbraccio a me distese, ficcai gli occhi per lo cotto aspetto, sì che il viso abbruciotto non difese la conoscenza sua al mio intelletto, e chinando la mano alla sua faccia, risposi, siete voi qui, ser brunetto."
Soon as he touched me, I could no more avert mine eyes, but on his visage scorched and seared, fixed them until beneath the mask of hurt did the remembered lineaments appear, and to his face, my hand inclining down, I answered, "Ser Brunetto, are you here?" Same scornful look, same rictus, the crowd dispersed. No one seemed to recognize the passage from the 15th canto of El Inferno, where Dante meets his former teacher, Brunetto Latini. Two Americans, who had finally managed to fish out a few coins from their knapsack, tossed Dante a hail of tiny coins. Same glowering, pissed-off stare.
"Ma che ci frega? Che ci importa? Se l'oste al vino ci ha messo l'acqua, e noi gedimo, e noi gefamo, ci hai messo l'acqua e non te pagamo. What do we care? Why do we give a damn if the innkeeper watered down our wine? We'll just tell him and we'll just say, you've added water, we won't pay. Oliver couldn't understand why everyone had burst out laughing at the hapless tourists. Because he's reciting a Roman drinking song, and unless you know it, it's not funny. I told him I'd show him a shortcut to the bookstore. He didn't mind the long way. Maybe we should take the long way. What's the rush? He said. Mine was better. Oliver seemed on edge and insisted, is there something I should know? I finally asked. I thought it was a tactful way of giving him a chance to voice whatever was bothering him. Something he was uncomfortable with? Something having to do with his publisher? Someone else? My presence, perhaps? I can take perfectly good care of myself if you prefer to go alone. It suddenly hit me what was bothering him. I'll be the professor's son tagging along. That's not it at all, you goose. Then what is it? As we walked, he put an arm around my waist. I don't want anything to change or to come between us tonight. Who's the goose? He took a long look at me. We decided to proceed my way, crossing over from Piazza Montecitorio to the Corso, then up Via Belsiana. This is around where it started, I said. What? It? That's why you wanted to come by here? With you. I'd already told him the story. A young man on a bicycle 3 years ago, probably a grocer's helper or errand boy, riding down a narrow path with his apron on, staring me straight in the face. And as I stared back, no smile, just a troubled look till he passed me by. And then I did what I always hope others might do in such cases. I waited a few seconds, then turned around. He had done the exact same thing. I didn't come from a family where you speak to strangers. He clearly did. He whisked the bicycle around and pedaled until he caught up with me. A few insignificant words uttered to make light conversation. How easily it came to him. Questions, 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 just to keep the words flowing. Well, I didn't even have breath to utter yes or no. He shook my hand, but clearly as an excuse to hold it, then put his arm around me and pressed me into him, as if we were sharing a joke that had made us laugh and drawn us closer. Did I want to get together in a nearby movie house, perhaps? I shook my head. Did I want to follow him to the store? Boss was most likely gone by this time in the evening. Shook my head again. Are you shy? I nodded. All this without letting go of my hand, squeezing my shoulder, rubbing the nape of my neck with a patronizing and forgiving smile, as if he'd already given up, but wasn't willing to call it quits just yet. Why not? He kept asking. I could have. Easily. I didn't. I turned down so many. Never went after anyone.
You went after me.
You let me. Via Fratina, Via Borgognona, Via Condotti, Via delle Carrozze, della Croce, Via Vittoria. Suddenly I loved them all. As we approached the bookstore, Oliver said I should go along. He'd just make a quick local phone call. He could have called from the hotel. Perhaps he needed privacy. So I kept walking, stopping at a local bar to buy cigarettes. When I reached the bookstore with its large glass door and two clay Roman busts sitting on two seemingly antique stumps, I suddenly got nervous. The place was packed, and through the thick glass door with spare bronze trimming around it, you could make out a throng of adults, all of them eating what appeared to be pettifores. Someone inside saw me peering into the store and signaled me to come in. I shook my head, indicating with a hesitant index finger that I was waiting for someone who was just coming up the road there. But the owner, or his assistant, like a club manager, without stepping down on the sidewalk, pushed the glass door wide open with his arm totally extended and held it there, almost ordering me to come in. "Venga, su, venga," he said, the sleeves of his shirt rakishly rolled up to his shoulders. The reading had not yet started, but the bookstore was filled to capacity, everyone smoking, chatting loudly, leafing through new books, each holding a tiny plastic cup with what looked like scotch whiskey.
Even the upstairs gallery, whose banister was lined with the bare elbows and forearms of women, was tightly packed. I recognized the author right away. He was the same man who had signed both Marzia's and my copy of his poems, Se l'amore. He was shaking several hands. When he walked by me, I couldn't help but extend my hand and shake his and tell him how much I had enjoyed reading his poems. How could I have read his poems if the book wasn't even out yet? Someone else overheard his question. Were they going to throw me out of the store like an imposter? I purchased it in a bookstore in B a few weeks ago, and you were kind enough to sign it for me. He remembered the evening, so he said,
Un vero fan! A real fan, then, he said loudly, so that the others within hearing distance might hear.
In fact, they all turned around. Maybe not a fan. At his age, they're more likely to be called groupies, added an elderly woman with a goiter and loud colors that made her look like a toucan. Which poem did you like best?
Alfredo, you're behaving like a teacher at an oral exam, jibed a 30-something woman.
I just want to know which poem he liked best. There's no harm in asking, is there? He whined with quivering mock exasperation in his voice. For a moment, I believed that the woman who had stood up for me had gotten me off the hook. I was mistaken.
So tell me, he resumed, which one?
The one comparing life to San Clemente.
The one comparing love to San Clemente, he corrected, as though meditating the profundity of both our statements. The San Clemente syndrome.
The poet stared at me. And why?
My God, just leave the poor boy alone, will you?
Here, interrupted another woman who had overheard my other advocate. She grabbed a hold of my hand. I'll lead you to the food so that you can get away from this monster with an ego the size of his feet. Have you seen how big his shoes are? Alfredo, you really should do something about your shoes, she said from across the crowded bookstore.
My shoes? What's wrong with my shoes? Asked the poet.
They are too big. Don't they look huge? She was asking me. Poets can't have such big feet.
Leave my feet alone.
Someone else took pity on the poet. Don't mock his feet, Lucia. There's nothing wrong with his feet.
A pauper's feet. Walked barefoot all his life and still buys shoes a size bigger, in case he grows before next Christmas when the family stocks up for the holidays,
playing the embittered or forsaken shrew. But I did not let go of her hand, nor she mine. City camaraderie. How nice to hold a woman's hand, especially when you don't know a thing about her. C'est l'amore, I thought. And all these tanned arms and elbows that belonged to all these women looking down from the gallery. C'est l'amore. The bookstore owner interrupted what could easily have been a staged tiff between a husband and a wife.
C'est l'amore, he shouted.
Everyone laughed. It was not clear whether the laughter was a sign of relief in having a marital spat broken up, or because of the use of the words c'est l'amore implied, if this is love, then... But people understood that this was also the signal for the reading to start, and everyone found a comfortable corner or a wall against which to lean. Our corner was the best, right on the spiral staircase, each of us sitting on a tread, still holding hands. The publisher was about to introduce the poet when the door squeaked open. Oliver was trying to squeeze his way in, accompanied by two stunning girls who were either flashy models or movie actresses. It felt as though he had snatched them along the way to the bookstore and was bringing one for him and one for me. C'est l'amore.
Oliver! Finally!
Shouted the publisher, holding up his glass of scotch.
Welcome, welcome!
Everyone turned around.
One of the youngest, most talented American philosophers, he said, accompanied by my lovely daughters, without whom C'est l'amore would never have seen the light of day.
The poet agreed. His wife turned to me and whispered, Such babes, aren't they? The publisher came down the little stepladder and hugged Oliver. He took hold of the large X-ray envelope in which Oliver had stuffed his pages.
Manuscript?
Manuscript, replied Oliver. In exchange, the publisher handed him tonight's book.
You gave me one already.
That's right. But Oliver politely admired the cover, then looked around and finally spotted me sitting next to Lucia. He walked up to me, put an arm around my shoulder, and leaned over to kiss her. She looked at me again, looked at Oliver, sized up the situation.
Oliver, sei un dissoluto. You're debauched.
C'est l'amore, he replied, displaying a copy of the book, as if to say that whatever he did in life was already in her husband's book, and therefore quite permissible.
C'est l'amore yourself.
I couldn't tell whether he was being called dissolute because of the two babes he'd wandered in with, or because of me, or both. Oliver introduced me to both girls. Obviously, he knew them well and both cared for him.
Sei l'amico di Oliver, vero?
You're Oliver's friend, right? One of them asked. He spoke about you.
Saying?
Good things. He leaned against the wall where I was now standing next to the poet's wife. He's never going to let go of my hand, is he? Said Lucia, as though speaking to an absent third party. Perhaps she wanted the two babes to notice. I did not want to let go of her hand immediately, but knew that I must. So I held it in both hands, brought it to my lips, kissed its edge close to the palm, then let it go. It was, I felt, as though I'd had her for an entire afternoon and was now releasing her to her husband as one releases a bird whose broken wing had taken forever to mend.
C'est l'amore, she said,
all the while shaking her head to simulate a reprimand. No less dissolute than the other, just sweeter. I leave him to you. One of the daughters gave a forced giggle. We'll see what we can do with him. I was in heaven. She knew my name. Hers was Amanda, her sister Adele. There's a third one too, said Amanda, making light of their number. She should already be around here somewhere. The poet cleared his throat. The usual words of thanks to everyone, last but not least, to the light of his eyes, Lucia. Why she puts up with him. Why ever does she? Hissed the wife with a loving smile aimed at the poet. Because of his shoes, he said. There.
Get on with it, Alfredo, said the goitered toucan.
C'est l'amore. C'est l'amore is a collection of poems based on a season in Thailand teaching Dante. As many of you know, I loved Thailand before going and hated it as soon as I arrived. Let me rephrase. I hated it once I was there and loved it as soon as I left. Laughter. Drinks were being passed around. In Bangkok, I kept thinking of Rome. What else? Of this little roadside shop here, and the surrounding streets just before sunset, of the sound of church bells on Easter Sunday, and on rainy days, which last forever in Bangkok, I could almost cry. Lucia, Lucia, why didn't you ever say no when you knew how much I'd miss you on these days that made me feel more hollow than Ovid when they sent him to that misbegotten outpost where he died? I left a fool and came back no wiser. The people of Thailand are beautiful, so loneliness can be a cruel thing when you've had a bit to drink and are on the verge of touching the first stranger that comes your way. They're all beautiful there, but you pay for a smile by the shot glass. He stopped as though to collect his thoughts. I called these poems Tristia. Tristia took the better part of 20 minutes. Then came the applause. The word one of the two girls used was forte, molto forte. Goitered toucan turned to another woman who had never stopped nodding at almost every syllable spoken by the poet, and who now kept repeating, straordinario, fantastico. The poet stepped down, took a glass of water, and held his breath for a while to get rid of the bad case of hiccups. I had mistaken his hiccups for suppressed sobs. The poet, looking into all the pockets of his sports jacket and coming out empty, joined his index and middle finger tightly together and, waving both fingers next to his mouth, signaled to the bookstore owner that he wanted to smoke and maybe mingle for a couple minutes. Straordinario Fantastico, who intercepted his signal, instantly produced her cigarette case.
Stasera non dormo. Tonight I won't be able to sleep. On the wages of poetry,
she said, blaming his poetry for what was sure to be a night of throbbing insomnia. By now everyone was sweating, and the greenhouse atmosphere both inside and outside the bookstore had become unbearably sticky. For the love of God, open the door, cried the poet to the owner of the bookstore. We're suffocating in here. Mr. Venga took out a tiny wedge of wood, opened the door, and prodded it in between the wall and the bronze frame.
Better?
He asked deferentially.
No, but at least we know the door is open.
Oliver looked at me, meaning, did you like it? I shrugged my shoulders like someone reserving judgment for later. But I was not being sincere. I liked it a lot. Perhaps what I liked far more was the evening. Everything about it thrilled me. Every glance that crossed my own came like a compliment, or like an asking and a promise that simply lingered in midair between me and the world around me. I was electrified by the chafing, the irony, the glances, the smiles that seemed pleased I existed, by the buoyant air in the shop that graced everything from the glass door to the petit fours, to the golden ochre spell of the plastic glasses filled with Scotch whiskey, to Mr. Venga's rolled-up sleeves, to the poet himself, down to the spiral staircases where we had congregated with the babe sisters, all seemed to glow with a luster at once spellbound and aroused. I envied these lives and thought back to the thoroughly libidinized lives of my parents with their stultifying lunches and dinner drudges, our dollhouse lives in our dollhouse home, and of my senior year looming ahead. Everything appeared like child's play compared to this. Why go away to America in a year when I could just as easily spend the rest of my 4 years away coming to readings like this and sit and talk as some were already doing right now? There was more to learn in this tiny crammed bookstore than in any of the mighty institutions across the Atlantic. An older man with a scraggly large beard and Falstaff's paunch brought me a glass of scotch. Ecco. For me? Of course for you. Did you like the poems? Very much, I said, trying to look ironic and insincere. I don't know why. I'm his godfather, and I respect your opinion, he said, as though he'd seen through my first bluff and gone no further. But I respect your youth more. In a few years, I promise you, there won't be much youth left, I said, trying to assume the resigned irony of men who've been around and know themselves. Yes, but by then I won't be around to notice. Was he hitting on me? So take it, he said, offering me the plastic cup. I hesitated before accepting. It was the same brand of scotch my father drank at home. Lucia, who had caught the exchange, said, Tanto, one scotch more or less won't make you any less dissolute than you already are. I wish I were dissolute, I said, turning to her and ignoring Falstaff. Why? What's missing in your life? What's missing in my life? I was going to say everything, but corrected myself. Friends. The way everyone seems to be fast friends in this place. I wish I had friends like yours, like you. There'll be plenty of time for these friendships. Would friendship save you from being dissoluto? The word kept coming back like an accusation of a deep and ugly fault in my character. I wish I had one friend I wasn't destined to lose. She looked at me with a pensive smile. You're speaking volumes, my friend, and tonight we're doing short poems only. She kept looking at me. I feel for you. She brought her palm in a sad and lingering caress to my face, as if I had suddenly become her child. I loved that too. You're too young to know what I'm saying, but one day soon I hope we'll speak again, and then we'll see if I'm big enough to take back the word I used tonight. Scherzavo. I was only joking. Kiss to my cheek. What a world this was. She was more than twice my age, but I could have made love to her this minute and wept with her. Are we toasting or what? Someone shouted in another corner of the shop. There was a melee of sounds. Then it came, a hand on my shoulder. It was Amanda's, and another on my waist. Oh, I knew that other hand so well. May it never let go of me tonight. I worship every finger on that hand, every nail you bite on every one of your fingers, my dear, dear Oliver. Don't let go of me yet, for I need that hand there. A shudder ran down my spine. And I'm Ada, someone said almost by way of apology, as though aware she'd taken far too long to work her way to our end of the store and was now making it up to us by letting everyone in our corner know that she was the Ada everyone had surely been speaking about. Something raucous and rakish in her voice, or in the way she took her time in saying Ada, or in the way she seemed to make light of everything, book parties, introductions, even friendship, suddenly told me that, without a doubt, this evening I'd stepped into a spellbound world indeed. I'd never traveled in this world, but I loved this world. And I would love it even more once I learned how to speak its language, for it was my language, a form of address where our deepest longings are smuggled in banter, not because it's safer to put a smile on what we fear may shock, but because the inflections of desire, of all desire in this new world I'd stepped into, could only be conveyed in play. Everyone was available, lived availably, to the city, and assumed everyone else wished to be so as well. I longed to be like them. The bookstore owner chimed a bell by the cash register, and everyone was quiet. The poet spoke. I was not going to read this poem tonight, but because someone, he altered his voice, someone mentioned it, I could not resist. It's entitled The San Clemente Syndrome. It is, I must admit, i.e., if a versifier is allowed to say this about his own work, my favorite. I later found out that he never referred to himself as a poet. Because it was the most difficult. Because it made me terribly, terribly homesick. Because it saved me in Thailand. Because it explained my entire life to me. I counted my days, my nights, with the San Clemente in mind. The idea of coming back to Rome without finishing this long poem scared me more than being stranded at Bangkok's airport for another week. And yet, it was in Rome, where we live not 200 meters away from the Basilica of San Clemente, that I put the finishing touches on a poem which, ironically enough, I had started eons ago in Bangkok, precisely because Rome felt galaxies away. As he read the long poem, I began to think that, unlike him, I'd always found a way to avoid counting the days. We were leaving in 3 days, and that whatever I had with Oliver was destined to go up in thin air. We had talked about meeting in the States, and we'd talked about writing and speaking by phone, but the whole thing had a mysteriously surreal quality kept intentionally opaque by both of us, not because we wanted to allow events to catch us unprepared so that we might blame circumstances and not ourselves, but because by not planning to keep things alive, we were avoiding the prospect that they might ever die. We'd come to Rome in the same spirit of avoidance. Rome was a final bash before school, and travel took us away, just a way of putting things off and extending the party long past closing time. Perhaps without thinking, we had taken more than a brief vacation. We were eloping together, with return trip tickets to separate destinations. Perhaps it was his gift to me. Perhaps it was my father's gift to the two of us. Would I be able to live without his hand on my tummy or around my hips, without kissing and licking a wound on his hip that would take weeks to heal, but away from me now? Whom else would I ever be able to call by my name? There would be others, of course, and others after others, but calling them by my name in a moment of passion would feel like a derived thrill, an affectation. I remembered the empty closet and the packed suitcase next to his bed. Soon I'd sleep in Oliver's room. I'd sleep with his shirt, lie with it next to me, wear it in my sleep. After the reading, more applause, more conviviality, more drinks. Soon it was time to close the store. I remembered Marzia when a bookstore in B was closing. How far, how different, how thoroughly unreal she'd become. Someone said we should all head out and go to dinner together. There were about 30 of us. Someone else suggested a restaurant on Lake Albano. A restaurant overlooking a starlit night sprang to my attention like something out of an illuminated manuscript from the late Middle Ages. No, too far, someone said. Yes, but the lights on the lake at night. The lights on the lake will have to wait for another time. Why not somewhere on Via Cassia? Yes, but that didn't solve the problem of the cars. There weren't enough of them. Sure, there were enough cars. And if we had to sit on top of each other's lap for a little while, would anyone mind? No, of course not. Especially if I get to sit between these two beauties. Yes, but what if Falstaff were to sit on the two beauties? There were only 5 cars, and all were parked in different tiny side alleys not far from the bookstore. because we could not depart in mass, we were to reconvene somewhere by Ponte Milvio, somewhere there at Via Cassia, to the trattoria whose precise whereabouts someone, but no one else, knew. We arrived more than 45 minutes later, more than the time needed to reach distant Albano, where the lights on the lake at night. The place was a large alfresco trattoria with checkered tablecloths and mosquito candles spread out sparely among the diners. By now it must have been 11 o'clock. The air was still very damp. You could see it on our faces, on our clothes. We looked limp and soggy. Even the tablecloths felt limp and soggy. But the restaurant was on a hill, and occasionally a breathless draft would sough through the trees, signifying that tomorrow it would rain again, but that the mugginess would remain unchanged. The waitress, a woman nearing her 60s, made a quick count of how many we were and asked the help to set the tables in a double-sided horseshoe, which was instantly done. Then she told us what we were going to eat and drink. Thank God we didn't have to decide, because with him deciding what to eat, said the poet's wife, we'd be there for another hour, and by then they'd be out of food in the kitchen. She ran down a long list of antipasti, which materialized no sooner than invoked, followed by bread, wine, mineral water, frizzante and naturale. Simple fare, she explained. Simple is what we want, echoed the publisher. This year, we're in the red again. Once again, a toast to the poet, to the publisher, to the store owner, to the wife, the daughters, who else? Laughter and good fellowship. Ada made a small improvised speech. Well, not so improvised, she conceded. Falstaff and the toucan admitted to having a hand in it. The tortellini and cream sauce arrived more than an hour and a half later. By then I'd decided not to drink wine because the two Scotch whiskies gulped down in a rush were only now starting to have their full effect. The three sisters were sitting between us and everyone on our bench was sitting pressed together. Heaven. Second course, much later. Pot roast, peas, salad. Then cheeses. One thing led to another and we began speaking of Bangkok. Everyone is beautiful, but beautiful in an exceptionally hybrid, crossbred manner. Which is why I wanted to go there, said the poet. They're not Asiatic, not Caucasian, and Eurasian is too simple a term. They're exotic in the purest sense of the word, and yet not alien. We instantly recognize them, though we've never seen them before, and have no words either for what they stir in us or for what they seem to want from us. At first I thought that they thought differently. Then I realized they felt things differently. Then that they were unspeakably sweet. Sweet as you can't imagine anyone being sweet here. Oh, we can be kind and we can be caring and we can be very, very warm in our sunny, passionate Mediterranean way. But they were sweet, selflessly sweet, sweet in their hearts, sweet in their bodies, sweet without a touch of sorrow or malice, sweet like children, without irony or shame. I was ashamed of what I felt for them. This could be paradise, just as I'd fantasized. The 24-year-old night clerk of my rinky-dink hotel, who's wearing a visorless cap and has seen all types come and go, stares, and I stare back. His features are a girl's. He looks like a girl who looks like a boy. The girl at the American Express desk stares, and I stare back. She looks like a boy who looks like a girl who's therefore just a boy. The younger ones, men and women, always giggle when I give them the look. Even the girl at the consulate who speaks fluent Milanese, and the undergraduates who wait at the same hour of each and every morning for the same bus to pick us up, stare at me and I stare back. Does all this staring add up to what I think it means? Because, like it or not, when it comes to the senses, all humans speak the same beastly tongue. The second round of grappa and sambuca. I wanted to sleep with all of Thailand. And all of Thailand, it turns out, was flirting with me. You couldn't take a step without almost lurching into someone. Here, take a sip of this grappa and tell me it's not the work of a witch, interrupted the bookstore owner. The poet allowed the waiter to pour another glass. This time he sipped it slowly. Falstaff downed it in one gulp. Straordinario, fantastico, growled it down her gullet. Oliver smacked his lips. The poet said it made you young again. I like grappa at night. It reinvigorates me. But you, he was looking at me now, wouldn't understand. At your age, God knows, invigoration is the last thing you need. He watched me down part of the glass. Do you feel it? Feel what? I asked.
The invigoration.
I swilled the drink again.
Not really.
Not really, he repeated with a puzzled, disappointed look.
That's because at his age is already there, the invigoration, added Lucia.
True, someone said. Your invigoration works only on those who no longer have it. The poet.
Invigoration is not hard to come by in Bangkok. One warm night in my hotel room, I thought I would go out of my mind. It was either loneliness or the sound of people outside or the work of the devil. But this is when I began to think of San Clemente. It came to me like an unidentified nebulous feeling, part arousal, part homesickness, part metaphor. You travel to a place because you have this picture of it, and you want to couple with the whole country. Then you find out that you and its natives haven't a thing in common. You don't understand the basic signals which you'd always assumed all humanity shared. You decide it was all a mistake, that it was all in your head. Then you dig a bit deeper, and you find that despite your reasonable suspicions, you still desire them all. But you don't know what it is exactly you want from them, or what they seem to want from you, because they too, it turns out, are all looking at you with what could only be one thing on their mind. But you tell yourself you're imagining things, and you're ready to pack up and go back to Rome because all of these touch-and-go signals are driving you mad. But then suddenly something clicks, like a secret underground passageway, and you realize that, just like you, they are desperate and aching for you as well. And the worst thing is that with all of your experience and your sense of irony and your ability to overcome shyness wherever it threatens to crop up, you feel totally stranded. I didn't know their language, didn't know the language of their hearts, didn't even know my own. I saw veils everywhere. What I wanted, what I didn't know I wanted, what I didn't know to know I wanted, what I'd always known I'd wanted. This is either a miracle or it's hell. Like every experience that marks us for a lifetime, I found myself turned inside out, drawn and quartered. This was the sum of everything I'd been in my life, and more. Who am I when I sing and stir-fry vegetables for my family and friends on Sunday afternoon? Who am I when I wake up on freezing nights and want nothing more to do than throw on a sweater, rush to my desk, and write about the person I know no one knows I am? Who am I when I crave to be naked with another naked body, or when I crave to be alone in the world? Who am I when every part of me seems miles and centuries apart, and each swears it bears my name? I called it the San Clemente syndrome. Today's Basilica of San Clemente is built on the site of what was once a refuge for persecuted Christians. The home of the Roman consul Titus Flavius Clemens, it was burned down during Emperor Nero's reign. Next to its charred remains, in what must have been a large cavernous vault, the Romans built an underground pagan temple dedicated to Mithras, god of the morning, light of the world, over whose temple the early Christians built another church dedicated, coincidentally or not, this is a matter to be further excavated, to another Clement, Pope Saint Clement, on top of which yet another church that burnt down, and on the site of which stands today's basilica. And the digging could go on and on. Like the subconscious, like love, like memory, like time itself, like every single one of us, the church is built on the ruins of subsequent restorations. There is no rock bottom. There is no first anything, no last anything, just layers and secret passageways and interlocking chambers, like the Christian catacombs, and right along these, even a Jewish catacomb. But as Nietzsche says, my friends, I have given you the moral before the tale.
Alfredo, please make it brief.
By then the management of the restaurant had figured that we weren't about to leave yet, and so, once again, served grappa and sambuca for everyone. So on that warm night when I thought I was losing my mind, I'm sitting in the rinky-dink bar of my rinky-dink hotel, and who should be seated at the table right next to mine but our night clerk, wearing that strange visorless cap. Off duty? I ask. Off duty, he replies. Why don't you head home then? I live here, just having a drink before turning in. I stare at him, and he stares at me. Without letting another moment go by, he picks up his drink with one hand, the decanter with the other. I thought I'd intruded and offended him and that he wanted to be alone and was moving to a table farther away from mine. When lo and behold, he comes right to my table and sits right in front of me. "Want to try some of this?" he asks. "Sure, why not?" I think. "When in Rome? When in Thailand?" Of course, I've heard all manner of stories, so I figured there's something fishy and unsavory in all of this, but let's play along. He snaps his fingers and peremptorily empties a tiny cup for me. No sooner said than done. "Have a sip." "I may not like it," I say. "Have one anyway." He pours some for me and some for him. The brew is quite delicious. The glass is scarcely bigger than my grandmother's thimble, with which she used to darn socks. "Have another sip, just to make sure." I down this one as well. No question about it, it's a little like grappa, only stronger but less tart. Meanwhile, the night clerk keeps staring at me. I don't like being stared at so intensely. His glance is almost unbearable. I can almost detect the beginnings of a giggle. "You're staring at me," I finally say. "I know." "Why are you staring?" He leans over to my side of the table. "Because I like you." "Look," I begin. "Have another." Pours himself one for me. "Let me put it this way. I'm not, but he won't let me finish. All the more reason why we should have another." My mind is flashing red signals all over the place. They get you drunk, they take you somewhere, they rob you clean, and when you complain to the police, who are no less corrupt than the thieves themselves, they make all a manner of allegations about you, and have pictures to prove it. Another worry sweeps over me. The bill from the bar could turn out to be astronomical, while the one doing the ordering downs dyed tea and pretends to get drunk. The oldest trick in the book. What am I, born yesterday?